This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Guns, germs, and steel are the historical factors that divided the world's winners and losers, author Jared Diamond wrote in his best-selling book on the bottom line of human history. In this hour, Diamond looks with us at a new factor, terrorism, and where it fits into his famous equation. The bill for evolutionary victory, says Diamond, is coming due. But first, we begin tonight's program with news from Singapore. Last month, local authorities arrested 15 members of an alleged terrorist cell plotting to bomb embassies, U.S. Navy ships, and other targets in Singapore. Bob Drogan covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times and is investigating the terrorist threat in Southeast Asia. Good evening, Bob Drogan.
Good evening. How are you?
We're well. Thanks for joining us. Bob, what's the significance of these arrests in Singapore as people continue to sort of take on board what they mean?
Well, it's important on several fronts. If you remember, after September 11th, there were roundups and arrests in Europe, and we began to get a sense of how extensive the al-Qaeda networks were. Mm-hmm. What we're now seeing is that as the European arrests have gone underway, that operations were shifting. Hello,
Bob. We've got you.
Sorry. Operations were shifting to Southeast Asia, and these arrests are the first time we've ever really had evidence that al-Qaeda was active in Singapore, that part of the world. And the operation there was quite extensive.
A lot of this information, we're told, came off of a videotape that the government in Singapore came into possession of. What was on the tape, and what does it tell us about what was being planned?
Well, the tape's significant in part because it was found in Afghanistan. So what that means is that, as we saw with the Osama bin Laden tape after the World Trade Center, that this was an operation that was directly had command and control from al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. So that's important. What it indicated, there were several things on the tape, but essentially what the authorities have announced is that there were three operations that were under consideration and in various states of planning. One of them was a bombing attempt of the United States, the Australian, the British, and the Israeli embassies in Singapore, and they were collecting something on the order of 17 tons of explosives for that. Secondly, was an attack on U.S. service personnel on as they traveled by bus from the port to their where they were staying. And thirdly, was at least consideration of an attack on a U.S. warship as it transited the Malacca Straits into Singapore.
That's the kind of thing that we associate with the Middle East. We saw it in Yemen, but we don't associate it with a kind of locked-down society like Singapore. What are U.S. intelligence services making of that very active planning directed by al-Qaeda going on in a country, in a city-state known for being pretty well sewn up?
Well, it's even worse than that. I mean, six of the 15 people who, or I'm sorry, eight of the 15 people who were arrested there were former members of the Singapore military, and one of the people who was involved in the surveillance of the airbase and the port facility was a fairly senior member of a local technology firm. So people are obviously fairly concerned about this. This particular cell, by all accounts, was based in the neighboring country of Malaysia, which is also, of course,
predominantly Islam.
Predominantly Islam, which Singapore is not. Mm-hmm. Is predominantly Islam. And in Malaysia, they've arrested 13 people as well. So it seems to be expanding. But it appears that Malaysia was the regional base, and Singapore was the place where they were going to make their hit, partly because the U.S. is just much more visible there. We've got military, ships going through and planes and service personnel who are stationed there.
There's been a kind of tendency to look at these reports from Asia, the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, as second tier, not so serious. But does this indicate that there's a real terrorist threat, that the Islamic network in Southeast Asia is something that's going to have to be treated with the same kind of seriousness that's been tracked down in Europe so far? Is that underway already?
Well, I think it is underway. We've got, you know, something close to 100 special ops commandos on the ground or on their way into the Philippines as we speak. The Philippines is kind of a special case because the bulk of the attention there has gone to an indigenous operation known as Abu Sayyaf, mm-hmm. which is really more of a bandit gang than anything else, but that has some very tenuous links to al-Qaeda back from the early 1990s. But there is increasing concern that there's a very large Arab student population there. There is increasing concern of the possibility of cells in Manila and in some of the other cities in the Philippines as well. It's a little unclear if the Philippine operation is in any way directly tied to what's happening, what has happened, rather, in Singapore and Malaysia.
And Bob, finally, what do the revelations in Singapore tell us about the viability of al-Qaeda after the U.S. attacks on Afghanistan? We're told that it's been disrupted. Its headquarters has, you know, obviously been kicked out of its quarters. Is there any interpretation going on as to whether or not this means that the network can and or will go on post the 9/11 kickback?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't know. You know, we the way the Singapore cell got rolled up is because of the interrogations of al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan and because of this videotape that was recovered there. So that's a suggestion that there is a the disruption was very helpful to cracking this. On the other hand, there's increasing fear among the intelligence officials I talked to that so many people have clearly fled from Afghanistan and are making their way down into these Muslim countries, and especially into Indonesia, which is the other country of great concern at this point, which is, of course, the largest Muslim nation in the world, and there's a lot of concern about what's happening down there. So the answer seems to be mixed. On one hand, we have rolled up a lot. On the other hand, there's a sense that these guys are just fading into the background, and we may hear from them again.
Bob Drogon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bob Drogon covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times in Washington. He spoke to us from Maryland. Why does America have so much compared with the Rwandas, Somalias, and Afghanistans of the world? Environmental historian Jared Diamond traced the roots of modern success back into human history in his 1997 bestseller, Guns, Germs, and Steel. It's no mistake, he showed, that third world countries have the most fragile environments, public health crises, and overpopulation woes. Now, says Diamond, the West must make an investment abroad or suffer the consequences. If centuries of human history brought us to 9/11, what can be done to prevent terrorists from lashing out at the West again? What is the long-term investment that America needs to make globally? We're talking guns, germs, steel, and terror tonight. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Jared Diamond is author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fate of Human Societies. He's professor of physiology and public health at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome, Jared Diamond.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you. Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is Jack Beatty, special coverage news analyst and a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Jared Diamond, we want to jump into your concerns that are immediate following 9/11, but take us back first for a moment for those few remaining human souls in America who have not read Guns, Germs, and Steel at this point, and remind us of your thesis there, and then we're going to ask you to connect the dots to where we stand now. But take us back to your fundamental thesis in the book.
Yes. The question that the thesis addresses is why history unfolded so differently on different continents. Why is it Europeans who conquered the New World instead of vice versa, with the result that you and I are now talking English instead of Iroquois? And the answer goes back 10,500 years. It has to do with differences in the environments of the continents, nothing to do about differences in people themselves, especially differences in the availability of wild plants and animals suitable for domestication, of which there was the greatest number and greatest diversity on the Eurasian continent. So Eurasians were the first to become farmers, and so the first to develop cities, writing, and guns, germs, and steel, the ingredients of conquest.
So, of course, that's over millennia at this point. It's had a long time to settle in, the effects of the geographic and environmental baseline that you described there. But are you saying that at this point it's still not about culture, it's not about Calvinist work ethic versus something else, Christianity versus Islam? You're still saying that at bottom it's still about geography, environment, resources?
Well, the answer for the last 10,000 years certainly is about environment and resources. As you get down to a shorter and shorter time scale and smaller spatial scale, you have to be more concerned about cultural problems. And today, of course, it's perfectly obvious that there are big cultural issues in both inequalities in the world and modern terrorism, but nevertheless, let's not get blinded by these cultural issues. It remains the case that the major factors predicting the wealth and poverty of nations today are ecological factors, namely where they're located and what that does to their public health, their environments, and their population planning or lack thereof.
So then take us on a quick tour, if you would, of the rise of the United States to, at this point, sole superpower status. You're drawing a line from the Fertile Crescent in the Tigris-Euphrates right up to the present day and the U.S. standing in the world?
That's right. There's a straight line, although it may seem almost comical to say so. There is a straight line from plant and animal domestication in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, 8300 B.C., to the position of the United States at present, because Americans feed themselves not just on New World domesticates. We eat more than corn and turkeys, and we also eat wheat and, from South America, potatoes and barley. Cows, sheep, goats, pigs, horses are major domestic animals. So the United States was refounded by European societies, which in turn inherited Fertile Crescent plants and livestock and Fertile Crescent technology. So that's the straight line from the Fertile Crescent to the United States today.
So then, are you saying that post 9/11, that straight line advance has to take some kind of crook in order to wait up for third world countries that have not advanced so richly?
I would say that it's now in our self-interest, never mind all the humanitarian considerations. If one wants to be hard-nosed about it, it's in America's interest and it's a matter of our survival to ensure that other countries catch up with us, because nowadays globalization means not only that we can send them nice things like Coca-Cola and the Internet, globalization now also means that they can send us things, some of which are rather unpleasant. So we really have to be concerned about the state of the rest of the world more than ever.
Does that mean that somehow, finally, globalization has trumped geography?
Partly, yes. I would say yes and no. It has not trumped geography in that there are many parts of the world that still suffer from big geographical disadvantages, but globalization has trumped geography in the sense that it's now possible to send things rapidly around the world. For example, it took thousands of years for horses domesticated somewhere in Western Eurasia to reach the coast of France and the coast of China, and that was fast by the standards of history, horses to spread within 2,000 years. But nowadays, you can transport a horse in a cargo plane in 36 hours anywhere in the world.
Jack Beatty, Jared Diamond got a lot of people's attention with his very provocative and forceful framing of human history in Guns, Germs, and Steel, and now he's saying that globalization is breaking down, it sounds to me, the dictate of geography, at least at the edges.
Yeah, and that can be negative in the way that he talks about disease coming back here, terrorism and so on. But it can also be positive. I mean, globalization can trump the limits of agriculture in societies long threatened by famine. It can trump the limits of through medical advances. People in poor countries can have diseases lifted from them. In other words, the potential is here, it seems to me, for the first time maybe in history. I'd be interested in his response, where really the family of man can, in theory, could be formed. That is, we could treat people thousands of miles away as if they were members of our family.
Jared Diamond, I want to get your response to that, but we've got to take a short break first. We're talking with Jared Diamond, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning bestseller Guns, Germs, and Steel, about how the world is knit together today. 5 years ago, he took us back in human history and gave us his powerful thesis of how certain countries and economies ended up on top. Is there a new perspective we need in the very closely, tightly knit world of 2002, the post 9/11 world? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. How does 9/11 fit into your biggest picture of human evolution? What are the big waves we're riding here? Can we change the trend lines? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, Jared Diamond, about the road ahead, Guns, Germs, Steel, and Terror, about how the United States and the developed world must, should, will act in an era when globalization is bringing not only the wealth of the world, but the woes of the world to the U.S. doorstep. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How does 9/11 fit into your biggest picture of human evolution? Jared Diamond, we're especially happy to have you on because, you know, we've been looking at this from a very up-close and urgent perspective for the last several months, and we've heard every prescription under the sun. We've heard that the United States needs to withdraw and not be so involved in distant parts of the world and let other regional powers kind of take responsibility for their own backyard. We've heard, on the other hand, that the U.S. needs to become a kind of new imperial power, projecting without shame its values and its economic strength into other corners of the world. What do you see, given your thesis for how we all got to where we are today, how do you connect the dots between the Guns, Germs, and Steel formula that you wrote about and what happened on 9/11?
Well, I would say that Jack just expressed it eloquently. A connection of the dots would be, as Jack put it, that globalization can be for the bad, and globalization can be for the good, and in particular, that the United States now has the technology and the wealth to cure the diseases of distant countries, which otherwise are potential trouble spots, and Jack expressed well by referring to the family of man. In particular, of the alternatives that you mentioned, should the U.S. withdraw, should we go back to the America First policy of 1940? Absolutely not. One could say that disengagement of the United States is what got us into the mess of September 11th in the first place. Should we become an imperial power? No, unless you think that our sending medicines and putting efforts into research on curing malaria and sending public health experts, if that's what's involved in being an imperial power, yes, by all means, let's become an imperial power in that sense.
So does your perspective then, are you telling us that you see another kind of big chapter change here? I mean, the takeaway I think a lot of people took from your book was that people ended up where they ended up on the planet with the resources at hand, and they followed self-interest, and we ended up in this sort of along a great range of different levels of prosperity and development. And that was sort of that's just the way it was. Are you saying now self-interest isn't enough? Is there some fundamental change in the way humans need to look at the planet and its resources? And from your study of history, are you optimistic that humans will do that?
Sure. Taking those two questions, on self-interest, what is new is that self-interest now mandates that we pay attention to other parts of the world. And that wasn't the case in the past. For example, when Polynesian society collapsed on Easter Island about 400 years ago, didn't have impact anywhere else in the world, and conversely, when Anasazi society collapsed in what's now the United States around 1120, no impact in Europe. But now, because of the globalization, as Jack mentioned, that does have far-reaching consequences.
And so, are you optimistic that humans who were quite well-equipped to follow self-interest are as well-equipped to follow this, what is it? It's a kind of mixture. You're saying almost philanthropy in the interest of the self.
You have it exactly that philanthropy now meets self-interest. And when you the goals of philanthropy become identical to the goals of self-interest. When you ask me, am I optimistic? People are often asking me, Jared, are you an optimist or a pessimist? And my answer is, I'm a cautious optimist. That's to say, if I were pessimistic, I wouldn't have had children and I would jump out the window now. And if I were optimistic, I wouldn't be devoting the rest of my life to trying to make people aware of environmental problems. Instead, I would say I'm cautiously optimistic in the sense that, yes, we have major problems, but they are problems that if we take them seriously and attempt to deal with them, we'll be able to solve them, but we're in it for the long haul and it's going to be a big effort.
So you describe how certain parts of the world came to be rich and others came to be poor, and now you're saying those two are connecting in a way that may be positive and maybe dangerous. Have we lost Jared Diamond?
No, Jared.
Oh, good,
Diamond's
good. I'm glad. I just heard
I'm
something.
Just
I thought.
Listening to your wise words.
Good. So, does this mean? Well, I guess the question is, what does it mean? What are you saying that the developed world needs to do concretely now after 9/11 to look ahead with a sense of fulfilling on your cautious optimism?
Sure. What the developed world needs to do is to spend money in ways that will help other countries in three specific ways. And my argument is that in the long run, it's going to be much cheaper for us to do some crisis prevention than to face a $100 billion cash loss from something like September 11th or to spend $1 billion a month on the war in Afghanistan. Three concrete things that we could do, three ways in which spending a little money will make an enormous difference overseas. Mm-hmm. One of those is public health. A second is family planning, and a third is the environment. And the reason I stress these three things is that if you look at the countries around the world that are trouble spots today, just tick off the list, Afghanistan, Somalia, Rwanda, Burundi, mm-hmm. Haiti, potentially Nepal, et cetera, all of them are countries with environmental problems, overpopulated compared to their environmental resources. So if we can do something to help them deal with these problems, that's good for them, and selfishly, it's also going to be good for us in preventing more disasters.
Public health, family planning, and environment, we seem sometimes barely able to manage those issues within our own borders. What particular elements within each of those categories would you see the U.S. going after in the third world?
Well, we could talk for about 5 hours about each, so let's instead talk for, say, 20 seconds about
okay.
public health, just as an example. In the case of public health, many third world countries have short lifespans, people chronically sick, high birth rates because families know that many of their children are going to die, therefore they have lots of kids to compensate for the ones that are going to die, and the result is a high ratio in the population of young people who are not working economically productive mm-hmm. to the relatively small number of workers. Things that we could do would be put modest amounts of money into malaria control, into AIDS control, into cholera, antibiotics to deal with cholera and AIDS, and into development of vaccines for malaria, which doesn't exist yet, and then putting money into clean water because water supplies, contaminated water supplies, is how cholera and quite a few other diseases are spread.
Okay, so there's public health. We got it. Family planning?
Sure. Family planning, again, the population explosion in countries overseas is an economic disaster because, again, much of the population is too young to work. And it's not that these people themselves want to have large families. Many of my friends in Indonesia, New Guinea, and other places really would love to be able to limit their populations, and they know about birth control measures, so they're frustrated out of their minds that they don't have access, they don't have either the access or the money to get these birth control
mm-hmm.
measures.
Mm-hmm.
Birth control is pretty cheap, both the technology and the education. That's something that the U.S. could do cheaply.
Hasn't been cheap politically in the U.S. And environment, finally?
Oh, environment, again, a long list of problems, but for 20 seconds, deforestation. In many countries, deforestation is a big problem, and that's bad for the country because deforestation means soil erosion and it deprives people of free forest products. Deforestation is part of the exploding problem in Indonesia and the Philippines today and also in Nepal. And things that we could do about deforestation include providing so-called conservation leases, that's to say paying people not to chop down their forest instead of to chop down their forest, and then restricting imports of forestry products from areas that are being logged non-sustainably, as well as setting a good example here at home.
Jack Beattie, Jared Diamond, Mr. Guns, Germs, and Steel says if you want to stop terrorism, here's the agenda. Go out into the world and fix up public health, family planning, and the environment. Do you see the United States rolling up its sleeves to do that?
Well, unfortunately, this globalization we've been talking about as a hydra having these good and bad effects, here you can see it as playing at least a partly negative role, and especially in public health. I mean, we just had Bob Kuttner on. His magazine, The American Prospect, has a whole issue devoted to globalization. And basically, it could be summed up in the title of one of the articles, The Mirage of Progress. And in public health in particular, there are no markets. The people in these countries can't afford to pay for some of these drugs. Therefore, there's no market for the drugs. And therefore, because there's no market, there's no research. Well, a government that really saw things, as Professor Diamond, in the large scale that he does, would say, well, we have to have more research, publicly subsidized research into these drugs. No, there's no market, but the diseases are there, tuberculosis, malaria, and we need to work on it. Well, that takes a departure from market logic. Family planning, well, there's a case where American domestic politics enters in. George Bush's father, when he was a congressman, was called Rubbers. And he was called that because he was a huge supporter of family planning around the globe through contraceptive. And he was that up until 1980 when he became Ronald Reagan's running mate. Well, since then, of course, the Republican Party has had a very large faction. I don't know how big the faction is, but it's big in that party that says, no, family planning of any sort is anathema that has anything to do with abortion. President Bush's first act on taking office was to limit funds on family planning to third world countries. And he just repeated that recently with the UN. And on the environment, well, this administration, of course, is taking the position that we can continue to use disproportionate amounts of the world's energy, and we don't need to enter into any global treaty that would have us all limiting the depredations of carbon fuels on the environment. And a big part of their objection is that the third world, the poor countries, get too big of a break under the rules of Kyoto. So Big hurdles with our current government, I think, for the kinds of farsighted measures Professor Diamond wants us to undertake.
And yet these issues aren't going to go away. Listeners, how does 9/11 fit into your biggest picture of human evolution? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Bob is on the line. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Hello. I think Dr. Diamond has many interesting points and many valid points for countries that are very poor, but I do not think these would be sufficient to begin with to stamp out terrorism as has happened in the States. For the simple reason, I can give you a couple of examples. I recently went to Cuba, and even though the country is pretty poor, average wage is about $25 a month, I don't think there would be any revolution. I don't think we would see any trouble as such from Cuba towards the U.S. or towards any other country, because there's a sense of pride in the sense of that they are controlling their own destiny. Mm-hmm. Whether it's true or not, at least that's the impression that I got by traveling extensively in Cuba.
Bob, let's put that to Professor Diamond. Jared Diamond, what about it? Bob may have more to say here, but he raises an interesting point that even if you fixed up public health, family planning, and environment, you might not waylay the kind of terrorism we saw on September 11th. What do you say?
Bob is correct. Fixing up public health, environment, family planning wouldn't solve all problems of terrorism. I think it would only solve about 80% of problems of terrorism, and I would be quite happy with that. And Bob is, of course, correct that there are poor countries like Cuba that are not today sources of terrorism, and there are also wealthy people like bin Laden himself who are terrorists. So I don't have 100% of the answer, just 80% of it.
Bob, are you satisfied with 80%?
Well, I think it's a good preventive measure, and it's a very important first step. But I think one's going to go well beyond that. And I come from Iran myself, and I saw in Iran, even though people were reasonably well off, bring down the Shah and replace it with an autocratic system. I think the reason they did that, to some extent, was because they didn't feel they were in control. I think it's very important to look at foreign policy and make sure that we back countries with a fairness that we expect them to treat us. You know, if, for instance, I think the U.S. policy towards Cuba is completely wrong, you know, there's and has been wrong for 40 years. I think current policy towards Iran is probably wrong. And a lot of other countries, a long list of it, policy towards Egypt and Saudi Arabia is probably wrong because We support dictatorial regimes, and the media hardly ever says anything. I think the only time that I started seeing things against Saudi Arabia, and I've been a highly vocal speaker of it, is after September 11th, because 15 of the hijackers seem to come from Saudi Arabia. It's for me, it's terrible that to read the papers every day and there's a pool of silence. I think Israel would be another good case in point where the U.S. policy is very pro-Israeli and unjustifiably so. You know, all the anything in the United Nations that is against Israeli atrocities gets vetoed by the U.S. And I think these things create pent-up attention mm-hmm. that over the long run could result in the kind of thing that we've seen.
Bob, we take your point, and we're trying to dig into all these issues right now here tonight. Jared Diamond, what about this? You know, Bob is very effective in pointing out the nuanced landscape of concerns, of emotions, of grudges and ill will that are out there. And more than that, even if the developed world were to embrace your agenda, who's to say that the Third World would necessarily embrace it?
Sure. I'm in agreement with what Bob said up to the last 30 seconds. As for whether the Third World would embrace the agenda that I propose, let's face it, it's a long-term agenda. It's not it's not an immediate response agenda, but that long-term agenda of dealing with issues of public health, family planning, and environment, it's not something that we are forcing upon them. It's something that many or most people in third world countries want desperately for themselves.
And how do you imagine this being executed? By nations? By the United Nations? By some kind of world government that we haven't even heard of yet? We know you deal in 10,000-year swaths. Are we talking another century before we get started, or can we wait that long?
No, we have to start tomorrow. And as for how to execute it, is it going to be governments, the United Nations, et cetera? It's going to be all of those things. Some programs are best carried out by the governments. The United States government is in the best position to pour tens of millions of dollars into malaria research through the National Institutes of Health. Family planning, for political reasons, may be better funded not by the United States government, but by non-governmental organizations. Other things are best done through the United Nations or UN, the United Nations Foundation. So we need a whole panoply, a whole plate of agencies attacking these problems.
Jack Beatty, what Jared Diamond is describing is not so different in its spirit from Tony Blair's speech of a few months ago, where he said the West has got to reach out and make sure the rest of the world feels well-treated and is clothed and fed.
No, and you know, already I think the war on terror has had at least one impact on Professor Diamond's agenda, and that is that the world now is going to allow poor nations to override intellectual property rights to essentially produce cheap drugs. And this was only done at the recent conference at Doha because we did that when we were confronted with the threat of anthrax.
Right.
So it's had at least that one benefit, one spillover benefit.
Jack, we've got to take a break. We're talking guns, germs, steel, and terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Jared Diamond, author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, about the road ahead, about guns, germs, steel, and terror, and what the developed world can do to diminish the odds of terror becoming endemic, a permanent feature of life on Earth. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Lisa's on the line. Welcome, Lisa. You're on the air. Hello, Lisa. Are you there?
Yes.
Hello, Lisa, are you there?
Yes.
You have a question?
Yes, actually, I had a comment. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, many of the points that you're bringing up about how, you know, goodwill can be sent across the world now in 36 hours is great. I think what we're lacking, both in our country and in other countries, is the political will to do good things. I think... you know, it's very hard for some of these countries to see the money inflow come in and use them for the right purposes. I think many of the systems are set up similar to ours, where you're in government for such a short time. Once people are in the government and power positions of power, they start benefiting from that power personally.
Mm-hmm.
And that taints much of what they do and how they act. So they may have come in an atmosphere of goodwill, wanting to do better and good things for their country.
But it doesn't always work out.
No. And
right. Lisa, let's put that to Jared Diamond. Our time is running down, and I want to get a few more calls in. But Jared Diamond, what about this? Lisa's asking about the political will. I guess we could look at it from both sides, in the developed world and in the developing world. Maybe a way of looking at this is, you've looked at the history. What are the examples you can cite of the richer countries acting out of the kind of philanthropic self-interest that you describe, and of poor countries being able to take it when it's given not as a natural attribute of their geography and resources, but as something you know brought and given or planted from the outside?
Sure. A example from 40, 50 years ago was that just after World War II, much of Europe was poor in the sense that it had been ruined materially and ruined economically, and the United States, through the Marshall Plan, decided, partly as a matter of self-interest, to put a lot of money into rebuilding Europe.
Right, but as your own book makes clear, Europe was riding on centuries, thousands of years of circumstances that prepared it to redevelop relatively quickly.
Yes, Europe certainly was fertile ground. Perhaps a more interesting example is cases in the modern world where countries have been able to help themselves, tropical countries with big environmental problems, by investing heavily in public health, for example. And the prime examples are the modern tigers of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Mauritius, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, all of them invested heavily in public health. And the result was an increase in lifespan, a drop in birth rate, and economic boom. Of course, it wasn't only the investment in public health, but without the investment in public health and bringing down their medical problems, Singapore, Taiwan, Mauritius would never be where they are today. Those are countries that help themselves.
Mm-hmm. So it can be done. Paul is on the line. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I'm a real big fan of Dr. Diamond's. I read his book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, specifically because I heard about it on WBUR.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically because I was looking for answers as to how September 11th came about, you know, what exactly was going on. And I found more answers to more questions in Dr. Diamond's book than anything I've ever encountered. And it put things into terrific perspective and clarity for me. And it's practically a turning point in my life.
That's great.
And sure enough, on page 410, in several paragraphs, he describes exactly how, in his view, the Arab world seems to have come to the situation that it finds itself in. I couldn't believe it. He specifically answered my question. However, I do know that denial is more than just a river in Egypt, and it's a very powerful psychological phenomenon. So my question to Dr. Diamond is or has your book, or is it going to be translated into Arabic, and or have you already heard from people from the Arab world? How are they taking your assessment of the situation, and how does that tie into what your recommendations are concerning preventing further terrorism?
Thanks, Paul. Let's listen.
Sure. That's a very interesting question. No, it has not been translated into Arabic, although I would love that to happen. It has been translated into 23 languages, and it happened that on September 11th, I was scheduled to meet with a significant figure whom I cannot name in the Arabic world when the gentleman's plane was turned back because of the crash. I would dearly love more engagement with the Arabic world, particularly because one can say that much of what Guns, Germs, and Steel is about is the legacies of the Fertile Crescent, what now is the Arabic world for the rest of humanity.
But, of course, at this point, Jared Diamond, there's a lot of ill will and bad feeling in the Middle East toward the West in general, not necessarily even an open door toward intervention there. How do you deal with the politics of resentment once they've built up? You've got a prescription here, but how do you get through the kind of tangle of human politics that sits in between?
Wow. It's a long-term problem. That would be the simplest thing I can say about it.
Can you cite an example where it's worked out? It worked in the Far East. Has it worked in the Middle East, which we've all been thinking about these last few months?
Well, let's see. Turkey is now a reasonable ally of the United States, and is not a potential source for terrorism. And let's think. Where else? flanking the Near East, of course, India. Syria nowadays, the situation does not seem as threatening in Syria as it used to be. So the picture is not entirely black. But I agree, we have big problems.
Jack Beattie, we've just got a few seconds left, but your thoughts. Here's the big view from a big thinker. How do we get it up on the rails?
Yeah, I wish he could speak with our president, frankly. I mean, you know, we need to hear him. This is a situation that cries out for leadership, doesn't, isn't it? I mean, for someone who says can say, look, here are the problems and here's what we need to do. And we're all waiting for that speech. We had some of it, I think, with Tony Blair. But, you know, after he made that wonderful speech, people were saying he wants to sort out the Third World and he can't sort out the London Tube. Mm. So there's always that problem. The politicians can sound so much more grandiose than anything they can do to deliver. But here's a point, and here's a minimalist agenda where people can understand what a difference it would make if life chances were better for the desperate people in this world.
Jared Diamond, I guess that's your bottom line.
I would say sell it to George Bush as a matter of self-interest.
All right, there's the marching orders. Jared Diamond, author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fate of Human Societies, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Today, President Bush made a quick trip down the Mississippi to talk about a strong defense, free trade, his new education bill, tax cuts, and love. Here are excerpts of a speech he gave this morning at a John Deere plant in East Moline, Illinois.
The role of government is not to create wealth. The role of government is to create conditions in which jobs are created, in which people can find work. And I want to share with you some of my thoughts about how best to do that. The first condition to make sure that people can find work is to make sure our nation is secure against an enemy that wants to attack us. That starts with having a robust, active, strong homeland security for our country. The second way to make sure we've got sustained economic growth is to make sure our public school system works well. Recently, last week, I had the honor of traveling the country touting the fact that I was able to sign a good education bill. I know I shocked people. I believe the third condition necessary to make sure people can find work, and those who have work can work harder, is to make sure that we open up the world for American products. Fearful people want to build walls around America. Confident people believe we ought to tear them down. I'm confident in the American worker. I know the American worker can outproduce anybody, anywhere in the world. I'm confident. The fourth ingredient is to make sure we've got an energy supply as we head into the future. I oftentimes talk about how important it is to be able to grow your own food. Part of the national security of the country is to know that we're self-sufficient when it comes to food production, that we can grow our own food. We don't have to rely upon another nation to feed our people. That's one of the luxuries this nation has. We don't have the same luxury when it comes to energy. We are too reliant upon foreign sources of crude oil. We got to do a better job of not only conserving energy, but it seems to make sense to me that when we've got energy on our own hemisphere and in our own states, we ought to explore for it to make us less reliant. It's in the national security interests of our country to have an energy policy. I'm amazed that anybody would think they could attack the country. They just didn't understand us. But I understand the great strength of our country, and it's the people. It's the people that live all across our land. I don't care whether you're Democrat or Republican or Independent. It's the people that make us great. You know why? Because this nation is a nation of heart and soul and strength. I am so pleased to hear the stories of moms and dads sitting around their dinner table asking the fundamental question about life. People assessing their values. What's the most important thing in life? And moms and dads are realizing it's to love your children with all your heart and all your soul. No, the evil one struck us, and they did serious damage. But in so doing, they lifted the spirit of the country in a unique way. They brought out the very best in America. The best in America takes place when somebody walks across the street and says to a neighbor in need, "What can I do to help you?" Somebody knows there's somebody shut in and says, "I think I'm going to go spread a little love today." The best of America takes place in our churches and synagogues and mosques when people walk out and listen to that call to love a neighbor like you'd like to be loved yourself, and then do something about it. All this takes place, by the way, these millions of acts of kindness on a daily basis, which helps define the soul and spirit of America. It takes place not because of government. It takes place because of the people of the greatest land on the face of the earth. My call to you is work hard like you do. Love a neighbor like you'd like to be loved yourself. Love your children. Tell them you love them every single day. Make sure they turn off the TV so they become good readers. And always remember that we're lucky to live in such a fabulous nation, the nation called America. Thank
you. Excerpts of President Bush speaking at a John Deere factory in East Moline, Illinois today. It was one of three speeches he made today in cities along the Mississippi River. You can listen to the entire speech on our website. Go to WBUR.org and click on special coverage. Jack Beatty, there's your president speaking. Is he ringing your chimes?
Well, it's interesting. He said the government can create the conditions in which wealth and jobs can be created.
Mm-hmm.
And he named four of these responsibilities: security, better public schools, open world for American products, and self-sufficiency in energy. I don't know that anybody could disagree with those goals, and it's laudable to hear him sort of lay that out. When you get into the nitty-gritty, it can look different, but let's give him credit. I mean, he represents a party that, in the Newt Gingrich revolution, their answer to public schools was to abolish the Department of Education. Instead, the president has increased funding for education. This is significant. He does want to open the world for American products. Unfortunately, the price of that, which was fast-track legislation in the House, passed by one vote, the price of that one vote was to close America to products from the third world, which gets into Professor Diamond's agenda about anti-poverty efforts in the third world.
It's got to work both ways.
It's got to work both ways. And, of course, energy supply, well, he did mention conservation, but then quickly turned to things like, you know, getting more energy out of the California offshore and out of the Alaska wilderness. And the question might be, well, is that the best place for the country to look for self-sufficiency in energy, or is something more needed on the lines of massive conservation efforts?
But it's a president who never stops wrapping his message in the compassion idea. Love gets a big billing there.
He's all for love.
That's our president, and we wish him well with it. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is WBUR.